This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, welcome to the programme. This is NewsHour from the BBC World Service, and we're coming to you live from London. My name's Paul Henley. First today, President Trump has never been shy of a trade war with China. His latest tariffs imposed on Chinese goods imported into the US have now started a new one. Beijing has announced retaliatory tariffs against Washington. From next week, there will be new charges added to US goods coming into China, with the steepest new tariffs on American coal and gas. This is how newsreader Huang Feng delivered the story on the Chinese state television channel CCTV.
The actions of the US seriously damaged the rules-based multilateral trading system, undermine the foundation of economic and trade cooperation between China and the US, and disrupt the stability of global industrial and supply chains. China firmly opposes the erroneous practices of the US and urges the US to rectify them immediately.
Laura Bicker, who is the BBC's correspondent in Beijing, has been telling me more about the Chinese government's response today.
Well, China has said it will implement a 15% tariff on coal, on liquefied natural gas products. It's then going to issue a 10% tariff on crude oil, agricultural machinery and large engine cars imported from the US. And that all begins on February the 10th. It's also launching an investigation into Google. It has also targeted a number of US companies. So this is a wide range of measures that China has decided to use to retaliate. But the date there, I think, is very, very important. February the 10th. That means there are a few days. There's an opening here. So as well as issuing these targeted measures, China is keeping the door open, which could help the world's two largest economies step back from the brink of a trade war.
I mean, it's brinkmanship, isn't it? That's what's going on.
Yes, the two leaders do have a call scheduled later this week, according to the White House. But there are signs, despite today's announcement, that China is prepared to listen, that it's in some kind of listening mode. I think, firstly, if you look at these countermeasures, they're very limited in scope compared to the ones Donald Trump has levied on China. Remember, he has levied a 10% kind of tax, a tariff on all Chinese goods heading to the United States. But when you look at what China has done, America is the biggest exporter of liquid natural gas across the world. But China only accounts for about 2% of those exports. And its major car imports are from Europe, from Japan. So this is very calculated. It's very selective targeting. And yes, it's brinkmanship. It's an opening shot by Beijing as a way of gaining maybe some bargaining power and leverage ahead of any talks.
And does it help that everyone saw this coming from Washington, presumably Beijing too?
Yes. I mean, it's my understanding that China has had officials, analysts in meetings that have been held by Washington think tanks, for instance, for several months now. They have been looking at what happened last time. They've been looking at what could happen this time. They are trying to find different ways to target Washington back if they've been targeted in the first place. But they have had, there has been repeated messages from Beijing for several weeks now that there would be no winners in a trade war. Beijing was willing to enter negotiations. And the last statement, certainly earlier this week before the retaliation, was urging Washington to meet China halfway. So there is a way of avoiding a full-out trade war. But let's not make any mistake here. Dealing with Canada and dealing with Mexico for Washington is a completely different kettle of fish than dealing with China. And any negotiation will be incredibly difficult.
Laura Bicker in Beijing. So how responsive is Beijing now likely to be to what's often called President Trump's transactional approach to negotiations? Professor Henry Wang is a former advisor to the China State Council, also the founder of the Center for China and Globalization in Beijing. I asked him how he viewed things.
It's not the first time to encounter tariff pressure. You know, we remember in the first term of Trump, China already got 20-30% of tariff levied on many of China's products. So this time we understand, you know, Trump has actually had a tariff for both Canada and Mexico and, of course, to China as well. But it's 10%. And I think that China is ready for that. And of course, China still hopes that through the talks, through the communications, both leaders and the government can resolve this. And also, from what China has proposed today, it's very minimum, symbolic. It's only 8 product category that they have a tax on 10% or 15%.
So if the actual deal is yet to be done, what does America want, do you think?
Probably in the inaugural speech, he wants to be a president of peace. He wants to be a unifier. He wants to end the Russian-Ukraine war. He wants to peace in Gaza. And, of course, he wants the North Korea nuclear resolved issue resolved and Iranian issues. All those needs China, but also, you know, global economy needs China. So he's if President Trump is only addressing all those international, you know, trade issues, economic issues, which is fine. China is willing to do that. Let's tackle the infrastructure deficit, not only just trade deficit. Let's tackle, you know, global debt and all those issues. So in that sense, if he's really pursuing economic and business approach, making deals, China probably can be a best partner for that. But he also wants to be a peace president, of a unifier of the world, which is fine. You know, I think, you know, China can support that if he wants to be a peace president and stop the war in the world.
How can China help end the war in Ukraine, especially if the new tariffs make it more likely that China will buy Russian energy?
No, I don't think that, you know, the normal trade is happening. But, for example, President Trump has proposed that let's Ukraine not join the NATO, but let's, you know, freeze the fighting regime and send in the European, you know, troops. I don't think Putin will take that. But if China can send peacekeeping forces there, you know, with UN, that probably work with Putin. I don't know. I mean, things like that, China certainly can help. I think there's many things can be talked about because China is a large trading partner with not only just Russia, but also with Ukraine. China also can help Ukraine to reconstruct.
It sounds almost as if you're welcoming the Trump stance at the moment.
No, I'm not saying welcome, but I had a better understanding because he's out of the business, businessman nature. He's prefer doing business, prefer more economic gain, prefer more investment, which is what China is doing all those years. And so if he's less ideologically driven, he's less autocracy versus democracy, that kind of a narrative. I think, you know, probably it sounds better to the country in the global south and, of course, to China.
What happens if the two countries fail to reach a deal?
Well, I think, you know, from the experience of the first administration, they've talked for many times. They did make a deal. And of course, I think that President Trump wants to make the deal, who else can be a better deal maker of the second largest economy? There's many ways China can make deals with U.S. But let's really be more focused on those business, economic, trade relations rather than, you know, on a geopolitical rivalry, on ideological divide and all those things. And China, of course, is never afraid of trade war, but China is also prepared to talk and trying to make a peace out of this.
But haven't you talked in the past about devastating consequences of the lack of a deal for the rest of the world?
Yeah, the trade war is certainly not the way to go. China's already today trade more with Belt and Road countries rather than go to the G7. But if Trump levy taxes on Canada, Mexico, or even he threatened to levy on the EU, that will drive more countries to trade with China. And in the long run, it's going to really devastating for the U.S. consumers and also not good for the world. But of course, we understand, I understand personally, that he's using this as a vehicle to start the talk.
The biggest problem, surely, between the US and China is Taiwan and its future. Will that feature in talks?
Well, I think that, you know, that's why I'm saying, you know, President Trump is less ideologically driven. I mean, he said before that Taiwan has stolen US chip technology and Taiwan is not paying US protection fee, insurance fee. If that is the attitude of President Trump, which is fine. I think that if America would like to do more business with China, if Americans like to have more economic development with this part of the world, I think if less driven with ideological. And Taiwan, of course, with China, with the economic integration, with 2 million people already from Taiwanese working in the mainland, I think, you know, 60% of the voters in Taiwan voted for non-independent party last year. So there could be a potential for unification if President Trump is less driven with these ideological differences.
And it doesn't ring alarm bells in Beijing what President Trump says about possibly invading Greenland? Does that not set a precedent?
You know, I think President Trump is having a very different agenda. He wants to consolidate North America, whatever reason he has, and he wants more expanded to Panama Canals or Greenland for resources. If they can make a deal, I mean, it's American business, you know. That might be a different approach, you know, to consolidate and pay attention to your domestic rather than really getting out everywhere and starting all the problems.
That was Professor Henry Wang of the Center for China and Globalization in Beijing. Well, the US is delaying a 25% tariff on Canadian goods for 30 days, as it did for Mexico, in exchange for tougher border security. But for many Canadians, trust in their neighbour is severely shaken and concerns remain over a lasting solution, as the BBC's Michelle Flurry found out when she visited the town of Windsor, Ontario.
In response to the threat of tariffs, some Canadian liquor stores had pulled US brands from their shelves. Tonight, they are being restocked, the trade war averted for now. But for some, the break may be permanent.
For me, a line's been crossed.
Monica Morelli cancelled subscriptions to Amazon and Netflix, two American companies, because of Trump's trade threats. She isn't planning to sign back up.
It's like the whims of someone who changes from day to day. It's not acceptable. And for me, like, I think it's broken something. I can't trust the U.S. to be the ally anymore.
At Laval, workers polish metal. Here they make parts used in other goods. They were bracing for the worst. Around 80% of Canada's exports end up in America. Even with the delay, Laval President Jonathan Azzopardi said questions remain.
The uncertainty is as bad as the tariff. This company has been in business for over 50 years. That 50 years of success came from both sides working together, creating relationships that took a very long time to create. And now knowing that that relationship was as fragile as it is, and that one person's agenda can change that whole relationship and change the course of a business that's been around for half a century, hurts a lot.
Here in Windsor, Ontario, you can see the American city of Detroit just across the river. Tonight, the feeling of betrayal by a neighbour replaced by a sense of relief. But for how long?
That was the BBC's Michelle Flurry reporting from Windsor, Ontario. And later in this programme, we'll be speaking to a Canadian government minister and get his view on the tariffs and the potential trade war. You're listening to the BBC World Service. Live from London, this is NewsHour. Coming up, the story of Habiba al-Askari, a child in Gaza suffering from a rare blood condition that causes her limbs to develop gangrene.
If she asks me for a biscuit, I cannot give it to her. If I hand it over to her, she gives me a look. I can't describe to you the look that she gives me. I can only pray to God to heal Habiba and make me a miracle on earth in healing her.
Coming in half an hour, our headlines first. China says it will start imposing new taxes on some American goods next week in retaliation for 10% tariffs on Chinese exports to the US. Reports from West Darfur say large numbers of civilians have been killed in clashes between Sudan's army and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces. More on that soon. And Israel's prime minister is in Washington for talks with Donald Trump about potentially extending the Gaza ceasefire deal. I'm Paul Henley. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC. Dozens of civilians have died as Sudan's army and the rival paramilitary Rapid Support Forces continue to fight for control of the Darfur region. There are reports that airstrikes by the military killed at least 30 people on Monday. It's the latest in a series of deadly developments in a civil war that's been going on for nearly 2 years now. Our Africa editor, Will Ross, joins us live. Will, tell us about the latest, please.
Yeah, well, to be honest, Paul, it's hard to keep up with the number of attacks that we're hearing about that are leaving quite a large number of civilians dead. But the two attacks on Monday that we heard One was in Niala city. That's held by the Rapid Support Forces, and it's understood that the Sudanese army carried out airstrikes that left at least 30 civilians dead there. And then there's another city, El Fasher. That's a city that the Rapid Support Forces have been trying to capture from the army for many months. And there are reports that 60 civilians died there when RSF forces fired heavy artillery. And it's sort of becoming clear that, you know, that the civilian casualties don't seem to sort of put off either side from carrying out the attacks. I mean, we're hearing again just in the last couple of hours, 6 people killed and 38 injured in a strike by the paramilitary rapid support forces on a hospital in Khartoum. So that's the sort of the latest one. But over the weekend, there was also the horrific attack in Khartoum, or in Omdurman next to Khartoum, that left dozens of people dead. So I think the staggering thing at the moment is the sheer number of civilians who are dying as the two sides sort of try and bomb and shell these areas to try and capture from the other.
One theory is that the army was caught off guard at the start of the war, but it's now had time to rebuild, recruit, rearm. Is there any sense of the direction, basically who might win?
Well, I don't think anybody thinks there can be a winner. What people are starting to see is that the army has made some significant gains in recent weeks, especially around Khartoum and further south, and that sort of has changed the nature of the war there, and the RSF is definitely on the back foot. But over in the Darfur region in the west of the country, as has been the case for many months now, the RSF still trying to take El Fasher, because if they get that city, that would mean all of the capitals in that vast Darfur region would be held by the RSF, and then you're really looking at a country that's split in two. I mean, logistically, I think it's been difficult for the RSF to try and fight on these numerous fronts. You're looking at well over 1,000 kilometres between, you know, the Darfur area where they're fighting and then the capital Khartoum, and it's difficult to fight on these multiple fronts. But we understand that they've had a lot of supplies from the United Arab Emirates, something the UAE denies, but that's helped them fight in terms of weaponry. And the army's managed to carry out more recruitment, but it does seem to be pushing through. And we're just hearing again in the last day that the Sudanese army broke through, ending a siege on a base, a military base east of Khartoum. Okay. So there are videos sort of showing the civilians and soldiers there celebrating.
But Will Ross, there's no I have sense to end that it either there. Side can Many win thanks. The whole thing. Sorry to interrupt you, Will. Spain is coming to the end of its olive harvesting season. In 2021, the world's biggest producer of olive oil began suffering a punishing drought. Farmers are still watching the sky, hoping for a better season in 24-25. But apart from climate change, there's another cause for anxiety. A deadly and hard-to-collect bacterium has killed millions of olive trees in southern Italy and in Cordoba in Spain. Dr. Blanca Landa heads up a project at the Institute of Sustainable Agriculture dedicated to stopping the spread of the microbe. Linda Presley met her at her laboratory.
It's a biosecurity facility, a quarantine level 2 facility. So the sluice is under positive pressure. It's to avoid any escape from the laboratory inside or some entrance from outside from the street.
Inside, Dr. Landa and her team keep a collection of deadly strains of the Xylella microbe.
It's considered one of the most dangerous quarantine pathogens, and this is due to the huge number of diseases that can cause in very important crops such as olive, almonds, grapevines.
And the big fear, of course, especially here in Andalusia, is the olive industry.
Only in Andalusia, we have over 1.6 million olive hectares, so you can imagine the concern of the olive industry.
Xylella kills slowly, clogging the vessels through which a plant absorbs water. And the only way it spreads is through insect vectors. They feed on an infected tree, then carry the microbes to the next tree they land on. It's believed Xylella first arrived in Europe in ornamental coffee plants from Latin America. Dr. Landa remembers her first sight of the havoc wreaked by the killer bacterium when she visited southern Italy in 2014.
I was completely astonished. So it was like being in a film of like atomic war or whatever, because all the trees were completely died and drying. So all the Puglia, all the area is affected.
The dying trees generated conspiracy theories. Scientists, an oil pipeline, large companies, even the mafia, all of them were blamed for the demise of countless olive groves. Farmers were distraught, chaining themselves to their ancient, diseased trees to prevent the environmental authorities from removing them, the only way to counter Zilela.
It was a very, very sad situation. They said, some of the farmers, to me, that they take care of the trees even better than their own child, you know, because it was their way of living. Everywhere you go, you see symptoms of Zilela everywhere, yeah.
And have they managed to stop it yet?
No, not at all, no.
Italy's lost more than 20 million olive trees to Zilela. And it's been detected in parts of Spain too, although not yet in Andalusia, which is why Dr. Landa's research is critical. In a large, secured industrial greenhouse, she keeps plant material that her team's infected with Zilela, including 11 varieties of olives.
What we do, we inoculate artificially, trying to simulate what the insect does, that is using a very thin needle. We inject a suspension of the bacterium in the trunk of the plants.
Okay.
So we don't work with insect vectors. It's too dangerous.
Especially if those insects escaped. There's still so much that's mysterious about the bacteria. Dr. Landa knows the plants in her greenhouse are infected, but none are so far showing symptoms.
We don't know when something happens in the plant that trigger the symptoms development. And when you notice, it's too late because it appears and it happens very fast.
And you don't know whether it's young trees or old trees, or do you know which ones are more vulnerable?
Normally, the older trees are more sensitive.
Part of the end game would be to develop olive varieties resistant to Zilela.
Second approach is to inoculate the plants, for instance, with the beneficial communities of microorganisms that can protect the plant of not getting infected.
And then there are efforts to attack Zilela itself.
We have some collaborators in the project that are searching for viruses that can infect the bacterium.
I asked Dr. Landa if the gravity of her research project gives her sleepless nights.
No, I mean, otherwise I won't sleep any day, but sometimes I had been very, very concerned, especially when we detected the bacterium in Spain.
Blanca Landa ending that report from Linda Presley in southern Spain, BBC World Service. This is NewsHour. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Paul Henley. As the ceasefire holds in Gaza, medical evacuations have resumed. The World Health Organization estimates that there are between 12 and 14,000 patients who urgently need to be evacuated for treatment. Among them is Habiba al-Askari, a child who suffers from a rare blood condition that forces her limbs to develop gangrene. Our special correspondent Fergal Keane has been following her case.
Well, at any moment now, Habiba will arrive here by ambulance and be transferred to the helicopter behind me. And from here, it's another journey. 30 minutes by air, approximately, to a man, where doctors will then try to establish a precise diagnosis so that she can get the treatment she so badly needs. Habiba al-Askari is suffering from a rare blood condition which has caused her to lose movement in three of her limbs. Two legs and an arm have gone black with a type of gangrene. Doctors treating her in Gaza's Nasser Hospital said she would die if she wasn't evacuated. Her mother Rana described Habiba's suffering.
If she asks me for a biscuit, I cannot give it to her. If I hand it over to her, she gives me a look. I can't describe to you the look that she gives me. I can only pray to God to heal Habiba and make me a miracle on earth in healing her.
Habiba is being treated by a team of doctors from the charity Medical Aid for Palestine. Dr. Riaz Wasaid from Manchester told our journalist about the seriousness of her condition.
We are really pushing to try and get her medevaced out of Gaza as soon as possible in order to save her life and to try and salvage whatever is possible out of her limbs.
Habiba's evacuation was postponed on several occasions. At one point, Israel approved Habiba's transfer but refused to allow her mother travel with her. That decision was rescinded last night in what Israel called an extraordinary humanitarian gesture. Then there was confusion over whether her 12-year-old brother could travel.
It was a tiring effort, but it brought a result and I got permission. Now my son Sohaib is left. Oh God, please let me not endure the fire of being away from him.
That issue was quickly resolved and Habiba, her mother and brother are on their way here to Amman.
Fergal Keane reporting. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is in Washington at the moment, where he'll become the first foreign leader to visit the White House since President Trump returned to office. Talks are expected to focus on the next stage of the ceasefire in Gaza. Shalom Lipner is a non-resident senior fellow at the Scowcroft Middle East Security Initiative with the Atlantic Council in Washington. And between 1990 and 2016, he served seven consecutive premiers at the Prime Minister's office in Jerusalem. Shalom, welcome to the programme. What do you think Mr. Netanyahu wants first from this meeting?
Good to be with you, Paul. I think that Mr. Netanyahu comes with a complex agenda, with a number of items on it. As you said, you know, there's the issue of sort of the future of the Gaza campaign and the reconstruction and what that looks like that he'll be discussing with the president, how that interacts with the current hostage/ceasefire deal. There's also the issue of Saudi normalization that's on their agenda, you know, for sure. And you know, the Iranian threat, the threat that a potential nuclear Iran poses to Israel and to the region. I mean, those are seen as the three big ticket items that will be on the prime minister's list when he meets with the president this evening.
It seems key that neither man seems committed to a permanent solution for Gaza.
Well, I mean, I think obviously they're working through the details right now. I mean, the primary commitment, at least as is coming out of Washington right now, is to see this stage of the deal, of the hostage deal, go through and to proceed to the next one. And the president clearly has designs to create some sort of package deal of all the moving parts here that would maybe conceivably create a sequence where, you know, Gaza is dealt with, maybe that moves on to the larger integration, the Abraham Accords agenda that he's talked about, and moving on from there. You know, obviously, like I said, there are a lot of moving parts here, and there are a lot of things still to discuss. Conceivably, he will find fundamental disagreements with the prime minister on how to go about that. I think that there's greater alignment between the outcomes that the parties would like to see than conceivably the path with which either one of them would like to take to get there. And I think, you know, that will form the core of their conversations, what that actually looks like to get from where we are now to a better future.
But two-state solution is a concept from the past in this conversation, is it?
Well, I mean, we haven't heard the White House put it on the table right now. Clearly, there's a lot of reticence, even more than in the past, within Israel since October 7th to talk about that now. Interestingly enough, on that note, I saw Israeli polling yesterday, which suggested that people were maybe still willing to you know, sort of countenance that idea sometime in the future. I don't think that, I mean, I would recall that even under the Biden administration, which was much more committed to that outcome, and even before October 7th, we had the administration talk about how that might be a goal into the future. We don't see it happening immediately. It's hard to see how that situation has changed. If anything, it's become, I would say, less likely in the immediate term. And I don't think that either one of the principles has actually embraced. In fact, they've said that that's not an outcome to which they are committed. You know, but I think we're all going to be waiting to see what it is that they actually are committed to when they come out of this with hopefully practical steps.
But what do you think that Trump can offer the Israeli government? Lots of speculation that he intends perhaps no more rebukes over the occupied territories, more freedom for the government to do what it wants there.
Well, it does appear from what we're hearing that he is sort of taking a broader canvas here and looking at possible trade-offs between different pieces. If I go back to my initial comment about the sort of the Palestinian basket, the Saudi normalization basket, the Iran basket, you know, what all those things look like together. Within that, I think that obviously, and we've seen this president already exercise that in other contexts domestically and in other foreign theaters right now to the United States, you know, he obviously has at his disposal a whole series of carrots and sticks that the United States can wield opposite its interlocutors. The question will be to what extent he chooses to actually employ those and opposite who. We don't actually know right now. That's something we're all going to be waiting to see what happens in the months ahead.
At this juncture, do you think it can be said that Israel won the war?
I mean, I think that they've certainly downgraded the threats that they were facing. You know, it's hard to predict the future on this. I think that we have seen that sort of the face of the region has changed categorically in terms of downgrading Hamas and Hezbollah and what's happened opposite Iran, you know, directly and involving its proxies. So I think that strategically Israel is obviously in a much better position than it was a year and a half ago. But much will, you know, depend on, you know, as I say, you win the war, but then you need to win the peace. And the question is, you know, what will actually happen next that could or, you know, could promote or undermine Israel's long-term future, depending on what we see for, you know, moving forward.
Many thanks. Shalom Lipner from the Atlantic Council in Washington. Now, one of President Trump's many recent executive orders has been an instruction to the US Treasury to create a sovereign wealth fund for the United States. Many countries around the world have got sovereign wealth funds. What exactly are they? And might one be a good idea for the US? Professor Adam Dixon from Heriot Watt University in Edinburgh has co-authored a recent book on exactly this topic.
Basic definition is a state-owned institutional investor, and they can come in all shapes and sizes from the very, very large, like Norway's National Wealth Fund, which is $1.7 trillion, all the way down to very small strategic investment funds in emerging markets or developing countries. So they range in size and including what they do.
Don't countries or states have to be running at a profit to have one? The U.S. has got a deficit of about $1 trillion, hasn't it?
That is true. And to answer your question, it depends, because in the traditional sense, you would assume that a sovereign wealth fund exists to manage some kind of surplus revenue, whether that's from natural resources or from surpluses in foreign exchange. But what we've seen in the last 10 years is the explosion of sovereign wealth funds in countries that don't have any money. You look across Africa and you see tens of new sovereign wealth funds being set up, and they're doing it with very little capital. And they're even raising money on capital markets to then go and invest. So the idea that you need a lot of capital, yes, in the traditional sense, that's true, but actually a lot of sovereign wealth funds exist today on very little amounts of capital.
President Trump says he wants to use such a fund for what he calls great national endeavors. Like what?
Well, I think this is the million-dollar question. And the way I look at it is how is this going to make America great again? He said yesterday in his executive order that potentially he would use the fund to buy TikTok. And I don't see how buying a social media company is going to advance American leadership, either technologically or even in terms of our soft power around the world. So what these big projects are remains to be seen, in my view. But the bigger question that needs to be asked is, the United States has the biggest and deepest capital markets in the world. It has world-class hedge funds and institutional investors of various stripes that can channel capital into the most innovative industries and sectors. And why the government needs to get in that game at a time when Trump ran on decreasing the size of government is unclear.
Do sovereign wealth funds tend to go with open, democratic, transparent governments?
So there are sovereign wealth funds that exist in democracies, including in Europe. Ireland has an effective fund, but it's a very small economy. The Australians, the New Zealanders, they have sovereign wealth funds that are independent and transparent and well-governed. So it is possible for a democracy to have a sovereign wealth fund. Now, it may seem be easier in countries that aren't democracies to manage a sovereign wealth fund because you don't have that political base that's asking questions. So it is possible for the United States to establish something that is well-governed and independent and transparent and, if you like, free from politics. But in the current political environment in the United States, I do not see this new sovereign wealth fund becoming independent and free of politics. If anything, it may have too much politics, and that's what concerns me.
Norway's is maybe the most famous example of a sovereign wealth fund. What does that country get out of it?
What do they get out of it? For its 5.4 million people, well, they have this nest egg that will last them for generations to come. But Norway was rich before it became rich. It was a well-governed political economy before this fund was set up. And I think that's the important thing, is that sovereign wealth funds are not some kind of panacea that can lead to development, that can lead to prosperity. If anything, they're a consequence of prosperity. But for fixing structural issues, for driving innovation, I think we have to be a bit reserved on what the potential is.
That was Adam Dixon, who's an author and academic at Heriot Watt University in the Scottish capital, Edinburgh. You're listening to the BBC World Service live from London. This is NewsHour. Here's a reminder of our top story this hour. China has pledged to impose tariffs on some US imports from next week in response to American tariffs on its products. Professor Henry Wang of the Center for China and Globalization told NewsHour there were several areas where Beijing and Washington could reach a deal to avoid a full-scale trade war.
If it's really pursuing economic and business approach, making deals, China probably can be a best partner for that. But he also wants to be a peace president of a unifier of the world, which is fine. You know, I think, you know, China can support that if he wants to be a peace president and stop the war in the world.
One other headline for now, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is in Washington for talks with President Trump while violence continues in the West Bank. I'm Paul Henley. This is NewsHour live from the BBC. Swedish police have been responding to a shooting in the centre of the country. The shooting apparently targeted an education campus in Örebro, and authorities described attempted murder, arson and aggravated weapons offences in an earlier statement. It was also confirmed in the last 10 minutes. One person had been critically injured, four others hurt. Let's speak to Emma Olsen, who's a journalist in Stockholm for a teaching union publication called Vi Lärare. Thank you for joining us, Emma. What more can you tell us at this point?
We can't say much more right now because the police haven't gone out with much yet. But I have been speaking to one of the teachers at the school who was evacuated. He had heard the shots and communicated to his colleagues through this app that they have. We also heard parents waiting for the kids and the kids describing blood and chaos at the scene.
There were some reports that the person responsible had been aiming shots at the police. Do you know anything about that?
There have been reports on that, but they are not confirmed as yet.
And you haven't heard anything about who the suspect could be, whether they're still alive?
No, not yet. There have been some information regarding that the suspect has been shooting himself. We know that one person is critically injured, but we don't know much more than that at the moment.
School shooting incidents are rare like this in Sweden, but yeah. Violent crime and crime associated with firearms is increasingly common, often gang-related. Mm-hmm. The teaching community must be worried by an event like this.
This is an extreme event by Swedish measures. We haven't had any gun violence at all. So we have also been reporting during the latest weeks at the Villara about the increasing violence towards teachers, even from kids' younger ages.
Tell me a bit more about that.
They have been noticing a large increase in numbers of reported incidents with also quite severe violence from kids directed onto teachers. And this is a major problem in Sweden, and the union has been called to meetings with Lotta Edholm, who is the school minister.
A major problem, really? Is it taking people by surprise, the fact that, that kids are behaving differently towards teachers in recent years?
There is some reports on that also regarding large classes, communion savings on schools, fewer teachers, and so on.
Thank you very much for coming on the programme. That's Emma Olsen, who's a journalist for a teaching union publication, joining us live from Stockholm. You're listening to the BBC World Service live from London. This is NewsHour. Now, a year ago, few people had heard of Mikey Madison. Now she's seen as one of Hollywood's most exciting young film actresses, thanks to her acclaimed performance in the movie Anora. She's been nominated for Best Actress at the Golden Globes, the BAFTAs, and now the Oscars. Our entertainment correspondent, Lizo Mazimba, has been talking to her about her rise to fame.
Do you want to get married to me, Vanya? You want me to be your little wifey?
The film starts out feeling like a fairy tale for Anora. A stripper turned sex worker, she marries the son of a Russian oligarch. But Anora, Annie to her friends, finds not everyone is happy about it.
This is not a real marriage. We're getting in annulled and you have no say in it.
Annie is an incredible blend of both fragility and strength. As an actor, you must love being able to play those extremes.
She's a very complicated character, very nuanced.
Sorry to interrupt that report. We hope to bring it to you later. We're going to turn now to the question of how much damage has been done to US-Canadian relations by the threat of steep new trade tariffs from the White House. Let's talk live to David McGuinty, who's a member of the Canadian government and is kind enough to join us live. After all the drama and the angst, Mr. McGuinty, of the past week, at the moment it's only a 30-day pause in this threat of tariffs. Any more clarity?
Good morning, Robin. When we set out to address these concerns raised by the president when he was first elected in his administration, we set out to stop any imposition of tariff. I think we succeeded in doing so. Yesterday for now, we have a 30-day reprieve, but we're working now to make some significant further investments in our border, particularly as it deals with the question, the tragedy, the scourge of fentanyl. Our objective remains the same, which is to not have tariffs on either of our economies.
This is going to be a short interview, so we'll get straight to the point. What are you making of the repeated talk from President Trump of Canada becoming the 51st American state?
Yeah. Well, Canadians would say that they beg to differ. That's not on. As they say in the UK, it's just simply not on. We're going to move forward and manage this relationship as best we can, as we have been doing for 150 years. This is the world's longest undefended border. It's something that we prize. It's something that we cherish. This relationship between Canada and the United States is a very special one. And so we're going to continue to manage that relationship. And, you know, it's important for listeners to also to recall less than 1% of the fentanyl entering the United States is coming from Canada. In the last 12-month period, 43 pounds was seized at the American border coming from Canada. 21,000 pounds were seized coming from the southern border into the United States. So we're going to continue to work together. We've got partnerships at different levels, and we're going to, I'm convinced, find our way forward on this one.
And given Trump's unpredictability, how worried are you now that companies thinking of investing or upgrading in Canada may just decide not to?
It's a concern, but I think as we work together and build a relationship with the new administration, that we work to what I call zero tariff outcome, because I think we have a choice to make in both of our countries. which is, do we want a win-win proposition or a lose-lose proposition? And I think most people in the United States would rather see a win. They understand the degree of interconnectedness. And I think we're going to have to just simply redouble our efforts to manage that relationship well.
Many thanks. David McGuinty, member of the Canadian government. He's Minister for Public Safety in Canada. Thanks for coming on the program and concluding this edition of NewsHour. Thanks to you for listening. Bye-bye for now.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking, and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.